A new bill aims to prevent a backlog of sexual assault kits in Wisconsin. We're talking about the bipartisan proposal on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 3 out of 4 sexual assaults go unreported. That's according to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. Attorney General Josh Call said at a news conference this week that this legislation would make sexual assault kit procedures uniform statewide.
This legislation sends a clear message, which is that we can never have another backlog of untested sexual assault kits again in Wisconsin.
Are you a sexual assault survivor or victim's advocate? What do you think of Wisconsin's policy on sexual assault kits? We're at 800-642-1234. Representative Melissa Sargent is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 48th Assembly District, which includes parts of Madison. She introduced a bill this week that aims to prevent Wisconsin from developing a backlog of untested sexual assault kits. Representative Sargent, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me this morning.
So what specific steps would this bill take to achieve that goal?
Well, under this bill, once someone has unfortunately experienced sexual assault, we will be providing parameters for healthcare professionals who are collecting the sexual assault kits, as well as parameters for how law enforcement agencies transfer these sexual assault kits so that our victims, our survivors, know that there are codified procedures on the books to make sure that we do not find ourselves in the same situation where we have this backlog, frankly, due to decades of failures. And we know that prevention and standing up for our survivors is definitely something that we need to be doing here in Wisconsin.
How important is it to have uniform procedures straight across the state at law enforcement agencies?
It is vital that we have procedures that everyone understands how it is that they will be followed and what it is that we need to be doing. Because at the end of the day, how we store these rape kits and for how long we store them and where we store them has a direct impact on holding people accountable for really egregious acts, as well as making sure that our survivors know that we have their back and that we want to make sure that they have dignity and a right to a fair and just process.
Would this bill include a deadline for when the Crime Lab needs to test the kits it receives?
It's a challenging question, quite frankly, because some of our survivors are not in a position where they want to have their kits tested right away. So we do have procedures and timelines set forth for the rape kits. One set of procedures for people who are ready to have their rape kits tested, and another set of procedures for how long it is we store rape kits. But primarily what we need to know is that where it is that the kits are sent and what timeline those kits are sent to where it is they are going, so that law enforcement and healthcare professionals can make sure that they are where they need to be. So when a survivor is ready, it can be tested.
So going back to 2014, when it was uncovered that our state had this backlog of more than 6,000 untested sexual assault kits dating back to the 1980s, how much did the state's lack of deadlines for sending kits to the crime lab contribute to that backlog?
I think that it played a really large part in contributing to that backlog. There was a lot of finger pointing and head shrugging and shoulder shrugging as to, you know, whose responsibility it was to get these kits tested and how to get them to where it is that they needed to go. But thankfully, through setting forth some pretty aggressive policies and getting some additional dollars and bringing this to the forefront, we've been able to really move forward in that. And what we need to do now as a state is make sure that we have clear statutes and procedures so that we never find ourselves in this position again.
We're talking with Democratic Representative Melissa Sargent about new legislation to prevent future backlogs on sexual assault kits. Representative, in 2017, you were part of this group of lawmakers who introduced multiple bills on sexual assault. These bills would have created a Bill of Rights for sexual assault survivors, required the DOJ to track sexual assault kits and report that information to lawmakers, and ordered an audit on sexual assault kit testing in the state. Why did these bills fail?
Well, frankly, I think that there are real challenges in the Capitol building to get things done right now because of the partisan divide. And that divide was even more challenging a couple of years ago. But people are realizing now that, frankly, standing up for survivors and making sure that we are holding people accountable for really egregious and harmful acts is not a partisan issue. And I come really feel blessed to be able to work with our current Attorney General, who is building a strong coalition of Republicans and Democrats, as well as community advocates and professionals, so that we can really address these topics and make sure that we don't find ourselves in the situation. I believe that this bill is just the beginning of how it is that we're going to be able to continue to work together in the best interest of people across Wisconsin.
So under this proposed bill, the state would store sexual assault kits for up to 10 years, and that's shorter than the statute of limitations for some charges of sexual assault. Is it possible then that evidence could be destroyed if a survivor doesn't decide to take legal action within the period of a decade?
So that is a concern. And ultimately, what it is that we have landed on with this legislation is knowing, you know, based on experience and how it is that we look at previous history, that these victims and these sex kits, we believe that this 10-year period is going to be in the best interest of them as well as for the state.
Why 10 years? Why not store sexual assault kits indefinitely?
Well, we find ourselves in a position of storage space, as well as knowing how it is that people come to the table and when it is that they need to have access to these kits. And the crime lab, working very closely with the crime lab and working closely with victim advocates, the 10-year period seemed like the best place to be right now.
So if this bill is passed, do you think there's still additional change that needs to happen? And will you continue working on this issue?
I'm absolutely going to be continuing to work on this issue. We do need additional change. And we also know that science continues to evolve. And we want to make sure, you know, DNA testing and how it is that we have moved forward as a society has really changed substantially over the last handful of years. So we need to stay on top of this. We need to make sure that we are bringing the right people to the table. We're hearing the voices of survivors. We have the correct scientists. We have fabulous people that work for the state crime lab and really passionate people on the ground. And it's vital that we stand up for the people in our society who have been victimized and make sure that we are holding people accountable to the best ability that we can.
Representative Sargent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Melissa Sargent is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 48th Assembly District, which includes parts of Madison. She introduced a bill this week with a bipartisan group of lawmakers that aims to prevent Wisconsin from developing a backlog of untested sexual assault kits. Coming up, we talk with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about his trip to the southern border this week and other issues on Capitol Hill, including the Mueller report. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump called on Democrats yesterday to return from their vacations and address a surge in illegal crossings at the southern border that the Trump administration says has become a crisis. You can join in with your thoughts and questions about the president's proposal for a wall along the Mexico border and immigration policies. We're at 800-642-1234. Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin was at the border earlier this week near El Paso, Texas, and he rode along on a night patrol. He toured a processing center housing families caught crossing illegally. He chairs the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing well. Before we get to the border, though, let's talk a bit about Special Counsel Robert Mueller's redacted report coming out this morning. What are you expecting here that will come out in this redacted report?
Well, I can't really predict. I'm sure we'll all be frustrated. I've read plenty of reports that have been redacted, even in a classified setting. So it'll be frustrating to go through it. But I think the redactions that the Attorney General is talking about, keeping grand jury testimony private, classified information, information related to other ongoing investigations, then finally, not revealing anything about peripheral individuals to the investigation is probably going to be appropriate, but that doesn't mean it won't be frustrating trying to read through it and try and interpret exactly what all's being revealed.
You've told the MacIver Institute before you thought the Mueller probe has been an enormous political distraction to taxpayers. Will today's release of the report on the 2016 Russia probe put it to rest for the American people, put it to rest for you?
Probably not. I'll be interested to see whether the special counsel really delved into exactly what drove the behavior of the FBI, the intelligence community, the Department of Justice, in terms of why they even initiate this investigation. Was it strictly on the flimsy basis of the Steele dossier, which was paid for by a political research organization, paid for by the Democrat Party? We'll see whether the American people get the full information here. I kind of doubt they will. It's one of the reasons I never really supported a special counsel being appointed right up front. I think that should have been the last step in the process. We should have concluded congressional investigations, which are always hampered when there's an ongoing criminal investigation. Those congressional investigations should have issued their reports. That would have been designed to make all the information public. Then, had there been cause to refer for criminal matters, individuals with the Justice Department could have been referred to the Justice Department. If there was a need for a special counsel, then you'd appoint a special counsel. So I think we just jumped to the special counsel way too soon. Now it's 2 years later, and we still don't have all the answers, and probably won't by the end of the day.
We had Democratic Representative Mark Pocan on our program yesterday, and he said that if the report is too heavily redacted, he'll fight it because he thinks Americans deserve to see as much information as possible around Russian interference in the 2016 election. How would you respond to Democrats?
Well, first of all, I think we pretty well know what the Russians did. We should be concerned. Their use of, in particular, social media, the illegal hacking into any emails account, it's obviously a crime, which is why Special Counsel Mueller has indicted so many foreign national Russians that are now residing in Russia. They'll never be brought to American justice. The good news when it comes to interference in our election is it's almost impossible to change vote totals. Other than with corruption potentially right on the ground if you don't have proper controls. A little more likely that you might be able to get into voter files, but there should be plenty of controls. And when people are made aware of the fact that people are attempting to do it, you can defend your voter files. The more difficult subject is really social media. It's a whole new world with the technology we're dealing with now in the age of the Internet. And social media, and it's going to be very difficult to police it. So Americans have to be discerning in what they're reading and take often most things with a very large grain of salt. That's just the world we live in today.
Talking with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, let's head to the border. You were just in El Paso in the last couple of days. What was it like there? What did people you spoke with have to say?
So it was very interesting. We've been holding hearings on border security or some aspects of the immigration system for over 4 years now, over 30 hearings. So what I really want to do is I want to just trace the whole process through from I even hate to call it apprehension, because these individuals are turning themselves in very close to the processing centers to the point where they just walk across the Rio Grande, which they don't even get their feet wet because it's just a trickle in El Paso, and they walk right into the processing station. They're processed very quickly in the first station, probably just an overnight stay. They're bussed out to another Border Patrol station to complete the documentation. Then they're bussed back to be turned over to ICE ERO. And then once ICE, the final area of DHS, completes the total documentation and they're in their alien file is what it's called, then they're turned over to non-government groups like the Annunciation House or churches who connect them with their relatives. A lot of these folks have relatives from the Central American Civil Wars back in the 80s. And they buy them a bus ticket or plane ticket, and that's the last we ever see or hear of these individuals. And there's about 900,000 individuals that have come to this country illegally as either unaccompanied child, but primarily as the members of a family unit since 2012.
So you...
900,000, and it's a growing crisis. So last month, probably about 65,000 alone.
You've said that the migrant crisis is out of control, and you said it's an achievable goal to reduce the number of people crossing the border illegally. So what steps should Congress take to achieve that goal?
There has to be a consequence. The ball is clearly in Congress's court. The president can't fix this. We have to change laws. And we have to take a look at what Michael Chertoff did when we had a surge of Brazilians coming to this country illegally through Mexico in 2005. He initiated a process of expedited removal for those that did not have a valid asylum claim. That's an important distinction to make. For those that did not have a valid asylum claim, and coming here for work is not a valid asylum claim, he initiated a policy, they call it Texas Hold'em, of expedited removal. It reduced the flow from 2005, it was 31,000, the following year is 1,400. Reduced the flow by 60% the first month, 90% the second month. So you need that consequence. So what I am suggesting is we pass a law that first and foremost makes that initial determination of the validity of asylum claim very fast, but very accurately. You know, right now, only about 15% of asylum claims are ruled valid. That's really too low an initial bar. I'm not talking about changing the asylum standard. I'm just saying that initial evaluation needs to be more accurate.
But some
and
people...
Those that clearly don't have a valid asylum claim, we'll still have them in custody so that we can actually remove them to the home country. Once we do that, people will not risk a half year or a year's worth of salary, mortgage their homes to come to America because they're just going to be returned. That's the kind of deterrent we need to be very humane. There's no family separations.
But Senator,
what we need to do to get control of the situation.
But Senator, some people have argued that this will discourage people from fleeing violence, from seeking asylum or from leaving dangerous situations. Does that concern you?
No, because if you have a valid asylum claim, you will be welcomed into this country. And a valid asylum claim is very specific. You have to be persecuted either by your government or the government can do nothing to protect you from persecution on five very specific areas of persecution, sexual orientation, religion. Don't have the other ones off the top of my head, but asylum standard would not change whatsoever. So if you have a valid asylum claim, you would still be able to get to America. And you'd be able to, go through that process. The problem is, and again, I was talking to the migrants. They're very open. Not one of them really claimed fear of persecution. They all had somebody here, or like, again, a relative, possibly from the 80s. They had jobs lined up. They're coming here for a job. And listen, I'm highly sympathetic. I really am. But that's not fair to the people that are waiting to get in this country through the legal process. These folks are jumping through the line. And by the way, if you're concerned about your American wages being depressed, it's people in this country illegally that can be abused by employers, not paid prevailing wages, not getting the types of benefits, not being able to enforce their worker rights. That is what harms American workers, people that have come into this country illegally and that are working. And by the way, even when you have an asylum claim, 85% are not ruled valid. You get a worker's permit after 6 months. We are incentivizing and rewarding people to come to this country illegally. It is an insane policy, and it has to end.
Let's talk for a moment tariffs. President Trump has said he'll impose a 25% tariff on cars made in Mexico shipped to the U.S. if Mexico doesn't help stem the flow of migrants. Do you agree with that policy, considering that it may undermine the pending trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada?
I'm not a fan of tariffs. Tariffs are just a tax on American consumers. I understand the president is trying to use tariffs as leverage in negotiations. I think that's exactly what he's trying to do here. He's trying to get Mexico and Central American government's attention to help us reduce this flow, which, again, should be the achievable goal of our policy. I mean, a lot of Democrats say we need to pour billions into Central America. Well, as long as Americans have this insatiable demand for drugs that have given rise to drug cartels, which are also part of the human trafficking organization, control the governments in Central America to a certain extent, certainly destroy the public institutions, we do bear responsibility, but we're not going to fix that anytime soon as long as we have this insatiable demand for drugs. So that might be a long-term solution, but I mean really long-term. We have a problem in the here and now. When you have 100,000 people crossing the border on a monthly basis, 700 people alone per day in El Paso, where we should have 28 Border Patrol on the border, we only have two and three because the others are processing family units. So this is this risks national security. If you're concerned about
Senator Johnson, we have to stop there. Thank you so much for joining us.
This country to our poor southern.
That was Ron Johnson, a Republican U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. He chairs the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Coming up, we talk about how diversity promotes equity in school as Wisconsin looks for ways to recruit more teachers of color for the classroom. That conversation after a news update here on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and now we're joining NPR special news coverage. We're about to hear Attorney General William Barr on the redacted Mueller report.
Hold our horses for a little bit, and then we'll learn more.
And we should just note the various cable television networks are now showing a lectern, a podium, where Attorney General Barr will speak. There is an American flag behind it, along with other flags. I guess that's what, the Justice Department flag, Ryan Lucas, or whatever it may be. In any case, a number of flags there. And reporters are standing by and waiting to hear from the Attorney General. I want to ask a question, though, of NPR's Mara Liasson, who is with us here. Because, Mara, we know of one substantive, not tactical, but real substantive decision the Attorney General has already made. He was presented with a report, by his description, that had pro and con evidence for charging the President of the United States with obstruction of justice. And Barr said, I decided to make that decision not to charge the President of the United States. And I believe he even added, if I'm not mistaken, this is not because of some constitutional belief that the President cannot be charged. It's because I believe this is not a case that should be brought. But this is a moment when we're going to actually see what the evidence was that he weighed, perhaps.
Right. And also just another piece to the who is Bill Barr and what does this moment mean for him? Bill Barr has been, for his entire career, a strong, extremely strong believer in a powerful executive. And he wrote an unsolicited, apparently, 19-page memo, I think it was 19 pages, to the Trump lawyers before, long before he was tapped to be attorney general, saying that the president can't obstruct justice if the activities in question were around something that he was legally able to do. In other words, the president is allowed to fire Jim Comey. How can that possibly be obstruction of justice? That's Barr's theory. And I think that if he's, I don't know if he's thinking about his place in history, but if he succeeds in making the executive branch more powerful and more untouchable, I think he would consider that a great success. And, you know, one of the there are many questions about Barr's actions. Why did he say that the president was spied on, using the president's words, instead of the president's campaign was the subject of court-ordered surveillance? He could have used neutral language, but he didn't. So that raises questions. He was playing to an audience of one. Why did he do that?
I want to review that for people who perhaps didn't follow that in recent days. Here you have the attorney general. It's known as he's about to make this big, high-profile release of the Mueller report. He wants to seem impartial. He goes before Congress. He's questioned, and he's asked about the let's call it the alternative narrative, the Republican narrative, that actually it's the Democrats who are the evil people and that they were spying on the Trump campaign in an inappropriate way. And Barr gave some ammunition to that side.
Right. And they were spying on the campaign, and the entire origin of the investigation is therefore tainted. That's the Republican argument. That's a question. Why did he do that? Why, other than to send a signal to the president that I'm on your team? That's a mystery. Why brief the White House lawyers, and why not be open about the fact that you briefed them? You know, why risk coming off as such a partisan for Trump when you probably didn't have to. So these are just questions, you know, around him. He has participated in some of the most aggressive, you know, pre-spin about this report. He's designed the narrative and pushed it. And I think the White House feels that Barr and the president have been very successful at creating the narrative.
And we're told we're less than 2 minutes away from hearing what William Barr actually says. And Sue Davis, I guess that's one thing to listen for. Does this feel like a pre-spin? Does it feel like a defense of the president? Does it feel like a straightforward description of things? I suppose we should be fair and note that Barr is being criticized for talking before the report comes out. You could imagine a scenario where they simply release the report without any discussion of what's in there or why things were redacted, and that could also be a disaster. Any way that you approach this could be seen as a disaster.
Well, we also know, you know, Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler had a press conference last night in New York in which he said he didn't think that this was the right move and that there is an absurdity to having a press conference with reporters where they can't ask the questions about the thing that you're talking about. I mean, it is certainly an aspect of being able to control what's being said and how it's presented.
Reporters could ask a question like, Attorney General, what is the thing that you least want me to know? You know, see what he answers there. And now it looks like William Barr himself is coming to the podium in a suit, red tie, with his glasses. He's got a red folder that he's putting on the lectern in front, and let's listen.
Good morning, everybody, and thanks for being here this morning. As you know, on March 22nd, Special Counsel Robert Mueller concluded his investigation into matters related to Russian attempts to interfere in our 2016 presidential election, and he submitted his confidential report to me pursuant to department regulations. As I said during my Senate confirmation hearing and since, I'm committed to ensuring the greatest degree possible of transparency concerning the special counsel's investigation, consistent with the law. At 11 this morning, I'm going to transmit copies of the public version of the special counsel's report to the chairman and ranking members of the Senate and House Judiciary Committees. The Department of Justice will also make the report available to the American people by posting it on the department's website after it has been delivered to Congress. I'd like to make a few comments today on the report. Before I do that, I want to thank Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein for joining me here today and for his assistance and counsel throughout this process. Rod, as you know, has served at the department for nearly 30 years with dedication and distinction, and it's been a great privilege and pleasure for me to work with him since my confirmation. He had well-deserved plans to step back from public service that were interrupted by my asking him to help in my transition. Rod has been an invaluable partner, and I am grateful that he is willing to help me and has been able to see the special counsel's investigation through to its conclusion. Thanks, Rod.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'd also like to thank Special Counsel Robert Mueller for his service and the thoroughness of his investigation, particularly his work exposing the nature of Russia's attempts to interfere in our electoral process. As you know, one of the primary purposes of the special counsel's investigation was to determine whether President Trump's campaign or any individual associated with it conspired or coordinated with the Russian government to interfere in the 2016 election. Volume 1 of the special counsel's report describes the results of that investigation. As you will see, the special counsel's report states that his, quote, investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. I am sure that all Americans share my concern about the efforts of the Russian government to interfere in our presidential election. As the special counsel report makes clear, the Russian government sought to interfere in our election process. But thanks to the special counsel's thorough investigation, we now know that the Russian operatives who perpetrated these schemes did not have the cooperation of President Trump or the Trump campaign, or the knowing assistance of any other American, for that matter. That is something that all Americans can and should be grateful to have confirmed. The special counsel report outlines two main efforts by the Russian government to influence the 2016 election. First, the report details efforts by the Internet Research Agency, a Russian company with close ties to the Russian government, to sow social discord among American voters through disinformation and social media operations. Following a thorough investigation of this disinformation campaign, the special counsel brought charges in federal court against several Russian nationals and entities for their respective roles in this scheme. Those charges remain pending, and the individual defendants remain at large. But the special counsel found no evidence that any American, including anyone associated with the Trump campaign, conspired or coordinated with the Russian government or the IRA in this illegal scheme. Indeed, as the report states, quote, the investigation did not identify evidence that any U.S. person knowingly or intentionally coordinated with the IRA's interference operation, unquote. Put another way, the special counsel found no collusion by any Americans in IRA's illegal activities. Second, the report details efforts by the Russian military officials associated with the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Organization, to hack into computers and steal documents and emails from individuals associated with the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton's campaign for the purpose of eventually publicizing these documents. Obtaining such unauthorized access into computers is a federal crime. Following a thorough investigation of these hacking operations, the special counsel brought charges in federal court against several Russian military officers for their respective roles in these illegal hacking operations. Those charges are still pending, and the defendants remain at large. But again, the special counsel's report did not find any evidence that members of the Trump campaign or anyone associated with the campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in these hacking operations. In other words, there was no evidence of the Trump campaign collusion with the Russian government's hacking. The special counsel's investigation also examined Russian efforts to publish stolen emails and documents on the Internet. The special counsel found that after the GRU disseminated some of the stolen documents to entities that it controlled, DC Leaks and Guccifer II, the GRU transferred some of the stolen materials to WikiLeaks for publication. WikiLeaks then made a series of document dumps. The special counsel also investigated whether any member or affiliate of the Trump campaign encouraged or otherwise played a role in these dissemination efforts. Under applicable law, publication of these types of material would not be criminal unless the publisher also participated in the underlying hacking conspiracy. Here, too, the special counsel's report did not find that any person associated with the Trump campaign illegally participated in the dissemination of the materials. Finally, the special counsel investigated a number of links or contacts between the Trump campaign officials and individuals connected with the Russian government during the 2016 presidential campaign. After reviewing these contacts, the special counsel did not find any conspiracy to violate U.S. law involving Russian-linked persons and any persons associated with the Trump campaign. So that's the bottom line. After nearly 2 years of investigation, thousands of subpoenas, hundreds of warrants, and witness interviews, the special counsel confirmed that the Russian government sponsored efforts to illegally interfere with the 2016 presidential election, but did not find that the Trump campaign or other Americans colluded in those efforts. After finding no underlying collusion with Russia, the special counsel's report goes on to consider whether certain actions of the president could amount to obstruction of the special counsel's investigation. As I addressed in my March 24th letter, the special counsel did not make a traditional prosecutorial judgment regarding this allegation. Instead, the report recounts 10 episodes involving the president and discusses potential legal theories for connecting those activities to the elements of an obstruction offense. After carefully reviewing the facts and legal theories outlined in the report and in consultation with the Office of Legal Counsel and other department lawyers, the Deputy Attorney General and I concluded that the evidence developed by the special counsel is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense. Although the Deputy Attorney General and I disagreed with some of the special counsel's legal theories and felt that some of the episodes examined did not amount to obstruction as a matter of law, we did not rely solely on that in making our decision. Instead, we accepted the special counsel's legal framework for purposes of our analysis and evaluated the evidence as presented by the special counsel in reaching our conclusions. In assessing the president's actions discussed in the report, it is important to bear in mind the context. President Trump faced an unprecedented situation. As he entered into office and sought to perform his responsibilities as president, federal agents and prosecutors were scrutinizing his conduct before and after taking office and the conduct of some of his associates. At the same time, there was relentless speculation in the news media about the president's personal culpability. Yet, as he said from the beginning, there was, in fact, no collusion. And as the special counsel's report acknowledges, there is substantial evidence to show that the president was frustrated and angered by his sincere belief that the investigation was undermining his presidency, propelled by his political opponents, and fueled by illegal leaks. Nonetheless, the White House fully cooperated with the special counsel's investigation, providing unfettered access to campaign and White House documents, directing senior aides to testify freely, and asserting no privilege claims. And at the same time, the president took no act that in fact deprived the special counsel of the documents and witnesses necessary to complete his investigation. Apart from whether the acts were obstructive, this evidence of non-corrupt motives weighs heavily against any allegation that the president had a corrupt intent to obstruct the investigation. Now, before I take questions, I want to address a few aspects of the process for producing the public report that I am releasing today. As I said several times, the report contains limited redactions related to four categories of information. To ensure as much transparency as possible, those redactions have been clearly labeled so that the readers can tell which redactions correspond to which categories. Now, to recall, those categories are 6E material, grand jury material, information that the IC believes would disclose sources and methods, information that would impair the investigation and prosecution of other cases that are underway, and finally, information that implicates the privacy and reputational interests of peripheral third parties. As you will see, most of the redactions were compelled by the need to prevent harm to ongoing matters and to comply with court orders prohibiting the public disclosure of information bearing on ongoing investigations and criminal cases, such as the IRA case and the Roger Stone case. These redactions were applied by Department of Justice attorneys working closely together with attorneys from the special counsel's office, as well as the intelligence community, and prosecutors are handling the ongoing cases. The redactions are their work product. No redactions done by anybody outside this group. There were no redactions done by anybody outside this group. No one outside this group proposed any redactions, and no one outside the department has seen the unredacted report, with the exception of certain sections that were made available to IC, the intelligence community, for their advice on protecting intelligence sources and methods. Consistent with longstanding executive branch practice, the decision whether to assert executive privilege over any portion of the report rested with the President of the United States. Because the White House had voluntarily cooperated with the special counsel, significant portions of the report contained material over which the President could have asserted privilege, and he would have been well within his rights to do so. Following my March 29th letter, the Office of the White House Counsel requested the opportunity to review the redacted version of the report in order to advise the President on the potential invocation of privilege, which is consistent with longstanding practice. Following that review, the President confirmed that in the interest of transparency and full disclosure to the American people, he would not assert privilege over the special counsel's report. Accordingly, the public report I am releasing today contains redactions only for the four categories that I previously outlined, and no material has been redacted based on executive privilege. In addition, earlier this week, the President's personal counsel requested and was given the opportunity to read a final version of the redacted report before it was publicly released. That request was consistent with the practice followed under the Ethics in Government Act, which permitted individuals named in a report prepared by an independent counsel the opportunity to read the report before publication. The President's personal lawyers were not permitted to make and did not request any redactions. In addition to making the redacted report public, we are also working with Congress to accommodate their legitimate oversight interests with respect to the special counsel's investigation. We have been consulting with Chairman Graham and Chairman Nadler through this process, and we will continue to do so. Given the limited nature of the redactions, I believe that the publicly released report will allow every American to understand the results of the special counsel's investigation. Nevertheless, in an effort to accommodate congressional requests, we will make available, subject to appropriate safeguards, to a bipartisan group of leaders from several congressional committees, a version of the report with all redactions removed, except those relating to grand jury information. Thus, these members of Congress will be able to see all of the redacted material for themselves, with the limited exception of that which, by law, cannot be shared. I believe that this accommodation, together with my upcoming testimony before the Senate and House Judiciary Committees, will satisfy any need Congress has for information regarding the special counsel's investigation. Once again, I'd like to thank you for being here, and I will now have a few questions.
Mr. Attorney General, we don't have the report in hand, so could you explain for us the special counsel's articulated reason for not reaching a decision on obstruction of justice, and if it had anything to do with the department's longstanding guidance on not indicting a sitting president? And you say you disagreed with some of his legal theories. What did you disagree with him on?
I'd leave it to his description in the report, the special counsel's own articulation of why he did not want to make a determination as to whether or not there was an obstruction offense. But I will say that when we met with him, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein and I met with him, along with Ed O'Callaghan, who is the principal associate deputy, on March 5th, we specifically asked him about the OLC opinion and whether or not he was taking the position that he would have found a crime but for the existence of the OLC opinion. And he made it very clear several times that that was not his position. He was not saying that but for the OLC opinion, he would have found a crime. He made it clear that he had not made the determination that there was a crime.
We're listening to Attorney General William Barr, special coverage from NPR News.
Given that, why did you and Mr. Rosenstein feel the need you had to take it to the next step to conclude that there was no crime, especially given that DOJ policy?
Well, the very prosecutorial function and all our powers as prosecutors, including the power to convene grand juries and the compulsory process that's involved there, is for one purpose and one purpose only. It's determine yes or no was alleged conduct criminal or not criminal. That is our responsibility, and that's why we have the tools we have. And we don't go through this process just to collect information and throw it out to the public. We collect this information. We use that compulsory process for the purpose of making that decision. And because the special counsel did not make that decision, we felt the department had to, and that was a decision by me and the Deputy Attorney General.
Yes. Or did the special counsel indicate that he wanted you to make the decision or that it should be left for Congress? And also, how do you respond to criticism you're receiving from congressional Democrats that you're acting more as an attorney for the president rather than as the chief law enforcement officer?
Special Counsel Mueller did not indicate that his purpose was to leave the decision to Congress. I hope that was not his view, since we don't convene grand juries and conduct criminal investigations for that purpose. I didn't talk to him directly about the fact that we were making the decision, but I am told that his reaction to that was that it was my prerogative as Attorney General to make that decision.
Attorney General Barb Hatham here at Fox News. Hi there. Is there anything you can share today about your review of the genesis of the Russia investigation and whether assets have been provided to investigate?
No, today I'm really focused just on the process of releasing this report.
Attorney General, senior Democrats in Congress have asked for Robert Mueller himself to testify. Robert Mueller remains a Justice Department employee as of this moment. Will you permit him to testify publicly to Congress?
I have no objection to Bob Mueller personally testifying.
Mr. Attorney General, it's not just Democrats who have questioned some of the process here. A Republican-appointed judge on Tuesday said you have, quote, created an environment that has caused a significant part of the American public to be concerned about these redactions. You clear the president on obstruction. The president is fundraising off of your comments about spying. And here you have remarks that are quite generous to the president, including acknowledging his feelings and his emotions. So what do you say to people on both sides of the aisle who are concerned that you are trying to protect the president?
Well, actually, the statements about his sincere beliefs are recognized in the report, that there was substantial evidence for that. So I'm not sure what your basis is for saying that I am being generous to the president.
You face an unprecedented situation. It just seems like there's a lot of effort to go out of your way to acknowledge how this.
Well, is there another precedent for it?
No, but it's unusual.
Okay, so unprecedented is an accurate description, isn't it?
Yes. Okay. What do you say to people who are concerned that you are trying to protect the president?
Eric. There's a lot of public interest in the absence of the special counsel and members of his team. Was he invited to join you up on the podium? Why is he not here? This is his report, obviously, that you're talking about today.
No, it's not.
The report he did for me as the Attorney General. He is required under the regulation to provide me with a confidential report. I'm here to discuss my response to that report and my decision, entirely discretionary, to make it public, since these reports are not supposed to be made public. That's what I'm here to discuss.
Propriety for you to come out and sort of what appears to be sort of spinning the report before the public gets a chance to read it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Looks like that's it from the Justice Department today, where William Barr, the Attorney General of the United States, has given some description of his process and some description of his conclusions on the special counsel's investigation and the Mueller report, which, just to repeat for those who had not heard, we expect to learn about a little bit later on this morning. Attorney General Barr said that at about 11 o'clock Eastern Time, that's just a bit more than an hour from now, copies of this report, redacted somewhat, he says, will be transmitted to key congressional leaders, and that sometime after that, the Department of Justice will make the report available on a website so everyone can see it. We could reasonably expect that if there was any delay from the Department of Justice, that congressional leaders might take the lead in releasing this report. NPR's Susan Davis is among those who are here and have been listening along. What did you hear there, Sue, that struck you?
I will leave the legal conclusions to my colleagues, but I will say politically, I don't think that could have gone better for Donald Trump, for the presidency, and for this White House. Attorney General Barr unequivocally said repeatedly and on multiple occasions, absolutely no evidence that the president, his campaign, or any American, for that matter, in any way colluded with the Russian government to undermine the 2016 elections. That is consistent with with the president's defense of himself throughout this entire process. And I think this is a good day for the president.
Remarkable bit of political messaging, although the attorney general surely would argue that it's not political messaging, but just a fact. There's a difference between colluding with someone and being criminally liable for conspiracy. We knew the Mueller report found no criminal conspiracy, but it had been widely noted that that could be different than colluding with the Russians. Barr went ahead and went farther today, didn't he? He said there's no collusion. He used the very two words that the president himself has used again and again and again in his defense.
He did. He put a period at the end of that sentence. And I think, again, I'm not speaking to the legal terms. I'm speaking to the political terms. I believe the White House will view this and his party will view this as a complete political exoneration of the president.
Okay, we have much more to discuss here, and we will continue throughout the morning and throughout the day. But again, reviewing, Attorney General William Barr says there is no criminal conspiracy. He justified his decision not to charge the president or anyone else with obstruction of justice, that there was no collusion, and that the full Mueller report or a fuller version of the report will be available to the public a little later on today. This is special coverage from NPR News.
And you've been listening to this NPR special coverage here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coverage of the released Mueller report continues on the Ideas Network with On Point, beginning at 9 o'clock this morning. On Point will lay out what's at stake politically and legally regarding the Mueller report. This afternoon at 4:30 on Central Time, a Wisconsin political scientist will help break down what we have learned from the redacted report. And join us on the morning show tomorrow at 9. We'll discuss Congress's reaction to the full Mueller report. We'll get your reaction as well. We'll have political scientists and American government expert helping us understand what the report means right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.